This week on Grape Encounters Radio.
The device looks like a medical device, right?
It does, a little bit.
Or maybe something off of Star Trek, perhaps? Yeah. Actually, not even a construction tool. It looks like it could kill people.
That's true.
And now, transmitting our signal to wine lovers of the world from our Atascadero Wine Cellar Studio in the heart of the Central Coast wine country of San Luis Obispo County, California. We bring you Grape Encounters with David Wilson.
Peel me a grape.
This week on Grape Encounters Radio, we're going to do something that you have never seen or heard done on any TV or radio wine show, but we're going to do it today. That coming up in just a couple of minutes. But first, a story that I think is a natural extension of what we talked about on last week's show. Devastating earthquake that took place in Napa and just did unfathomable damage there. We had an interview scheduled for last week that we had to postpone for a week because of the damage that had occurred in Napa and the importance of that story. Now, our Grape Encounters microphones take us to a very interesting place. There are a lot of places like this in wine countries around the world. I think it's really a great topic to be speaking of today because we're going to talk about wine storage. And wine storage is a huge responsibility because it goes far beyond just worrying about things like earthquakes. There is so much that can go wrong if you do not store wine properly. I am now with Cindy Lewis and little brother, right?
Little brother.
You call him?
I call him Jimmy Joe.
Jimmy Joe, but we'll call him James, right?
We'll call him James since he's 6'5". James Nuno.
And you guys do a lot of different things here. You're in Paso Robles, but the main thrust of the business here is wine storage, right? Well, wine storage and sales, really, right?
Wine storage, sales, facilities, services. So we started, though, yes, in wine storage, and the business expanded as the need.
You guys are kind of all things to all people.
We began thinking we would store case goods. That was our initial idea. Then bonded case goods came into play. And then somebody said, would you store barrels? And we said, sure. And then would you maintain our barrels? And we moved to that. And then we found that we had really wonderful vintners that were not represented. So we got our wholesale license. And now we're distributing wines for a lot of the local wineries as well. And then we found the need for crush. So this year will be our first year crushing at our facility.
A serious question to you, Cindy, okay? And you know the question I'm going to ask you. The damage sustained in Napa is unfathomable. And, you know, it seems like most of that was in wineries. And it appears that the biggest devastation was barrels coming down. Enormous losses that way. You store both barrels here, wine that's already packaged in cases. And of course, Paso Robles just 10 years ago and 8 months had a 6.3 earthquake, which was just a little bit stronger than the one in Napa, which was 6.1. What do you do now? We all learned from the Paso Robles quake. Will you be studying what's happening or what actually happened in Napa to see what can be done to better protect wine in those kinds of circumstances?
Well, certainly it'll be a wait and see. Certainly we'll learn from their mistakes and or, you know, however they're going to proceed. Our first focus always is safety. So we do have some safety things in place. For example, we don't allow our guys to go in between our barrels because we don't want them to be caught in an earthquake. So the first thing is safety for our employees. Second is safety of the wine. We care about our customers' wine as much as they do. At this point, you know, we've not seen that happen here where barrels have toppled. And there may be something that comes from Napa that we implement. But that's for sure at this point going to be a wait and see.
I've got to imagine that throughout the region here, Paso Robles being one of the really now large regions in the country producing an enormous amount of wine, that anybody that's storing wine has to have the Paso quake of 2003 in the back of their mind. But now I'm guessing that's really become front and center in the wake of the Napa quake.
Well, certainly, you know, you never know when things like that are going to happen. And we certainly have as many precautions in place that we can right now that we know of, right? There is no strapping system or anything. Wouldn't be practical, I wouldn't think, at this point. But we do stack in our barrels. And so, you know, we'll have to just, again, it'll just be a wait and see. And we hope to learn from what
I know the racking systems in the cradles that are are used for barrels these days are a lot different than they used to be. And I think they're a lot sturdier.
Certainly more secure. You know, there's certainly some engineering things that have changed.
Okay. I want to get into a part of your business that I think is very fascinating, because as I walked through the warehouse earlier, I mean, there's an enormous amount of wine in here. I don't know how many square feet of wine, but it is a huge amount of wine. There's enough for one of my parties to last six days, probably.
Come on down.
Yeah. But there's a ton of wine in here. You know, a lot can go wrong. Wine is a very fragile commodity. So as I walked through here, it's a pretty warm day here. I walked into the warehouse. The beads of sweat immediately dried up. It was cool and comfortable. What temperature, first of all, do you have to keep the warehouses at?
So we keep our warehouse somewhere between 57 degrees and 60 degrees. So that's our mark that we look at. And then we do some things. So we obviously are heavily insulated. We were a building manufacturer and a construction company. That was our original business. So insulating the building was an important factor. Instead of one air conditioning unit that most places run, we have two air conditioning units. The other factor that we take into consideration is we have a night passive cooling system. And we have wonderfully cool nights here in Paso Robles.
Which is a very, very, no pun intended, but cool thing that businesses like yours do. They take advantage of Mother Nature.
Yes. Draws in the cool air from outside at a low level. And then there's a fan at the opposite end of each building. And each section of our buildings, the three sections, they each have their own passive cooling system so that we can move the air. And the other thing it does, because you're in here and you're running forklifts and you're running equipment, we want to freshen the air every night as well. So it's temperature controlled. When the temperature outside reaches a certain degrees, we pull that cool air in. And so every single day, we try to start our day at about a 57 degrees. So then we're starting cool. We're not holding that air in.
What's the maximum temperature that you would allow in the warehouse?
I would say, you know, we would consider it serious if we got up to about 63 degrees, 64 degrees. You know,
so is there redundancy if the power goes down? Is there a generator that kicks in?
There is not. So, you know, wine also cools the environment as well. So once you get a room full of barrels that you've cooled the room to 56 or 57 degrees, that wine will hold its cool for a while. So
I think that's a really interesting point, by the way. When you've got enormous stacks of case goods, that's going to stay cool for a very long time.
Right. So we're here every day. If the power goes out, we have a notification. So we know the power's gone out at the facility. We get a notification via computer. And we come down and we see we've not ever had that happen. So we've never tested that system. And we've actually never had any of our air conditions fail. So we've been fortunate. We have them serviced twice a year. You know, so we do things to kind of hedge our bet. And the passive cooling system is going to kick in the evening anyways. And the only time we don't do that is in the winter when the air gets too cold.
How many family members work here at Nuno Storage and Sales and everything else?
Me.
You're the boss.
I'm the boss. So it's me, my two sons, John and Matt, James, my brother, who is my son's age, and then my nephew, Nathan, my brother Michael's son.
So the kinds of wineries that bring, first of all, the barrels here and then also store their finished goods here, are they usually smaller wineries or what, you know, what brings them to a facility like this and why do they not do it on their own?
Well, certainly cost. To make your wine here and to keep your barrels here, the cost is substantially less. So, you know, I would imagine that, you know, most of our wineries are under 30,000 case wineries. So anywhere from 500 cases to, you know, 20 or 30,000.
And I'm imagining that there's some real economies of scale when it comes to the air conditioning as well. I'm sure your electric bill is horrifying, but if you amortize that over a lot of accounts, it becomes very manageable.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So in the last minute that we have here, James, maybe you can elaborate on this. People can picture and have probably seen barrel rooms where barrels are stacked to the ceiling, maybe don't realize how much TLC has to be given to those barrels until they actually wind up in the bottles. And really, even beyond that, you know, talk about what has to happen while the wine's in the barrel, because it's not just a matter of storing it.
Yeah. So here we offer all of the services that go along with maintaining the barrels, and these smaller wineries, that's a big cost for them if they're doing
it. So kind of run down what those services are.
So anything from topping to SO2 to maintenance on the barrel. If the barrel has some kind of leak,
it's compromised in some way,
we can fix
that. Ah, that structural engineering comes in handy there.
Yeah. You know, really reinforce those barrels nice and strong. And then from there, we can also then help provide services transitioning from the barrel into bottling.
So the topping and the SO2, how is that accomplished? And for those who may not know what that means, can you just explain briefly?
So topping and SO2ing, on an average person or vintner, they will do it once every 3 months. They will have the barrel checked. And because the barrels are made of wood, they breathe. You can lose wine to evaporation. So there will actually be less wine. No one's drinking it. It's
pretty amazing, actually, how much evaporation actually occurs in a barrel. Cindy, do you ever worry that you might overlook something, or have you built in systems that make that relatively impossible?
Matthew, who is our warehouse manager, has a great nose for wine as well. And honestly, there have been times he has walked by a barrel and said, something's not right. I can smell it. I can smell it in the air.
Well, speaking of smelling it, coming up next, if you could smell what was inside a sealed bottle, you would know whether or not the bottle is turned. But now there's a new way to know, and Sarah Schneider, wine editor of Sunset Magazine, and somebody very special to me, will be joining me in the studio. It's such a pleasure to have you guys on.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Cindy Lewis and James Nuno of Nuno Storage and Wine Sales and all that other good stuff. Your grape encounter will continue right after this. And your grape encounter continues. And if you were with us a couple of weeks ago, you know we had on Nick Lazaris, who is the CEO of Corvin. They make the most amazing device, maybe one of the most significant devices ever made for wine lovers and aficionados. We promised that we would be doing an in-house demonstration of this incredible product, and we're going to do it today. We were going to do it last week, but we had to do our special report of the earthquake that hit the Napa and Sonoma valleys. It's time for Sipping with Sarah, and we have a very special guest today. We've never had a guest on Sipping with Sarah other than me. It's funny that we call it Sipping with Sarah. We don't even say it's Sipping with Sarah and David, right?
Your whole show is Sipping with David.
Oh, oh, I see. So,
but this is going to be special today.
Do you want to introduce this segment?
I don't have your flair.
But who's our special guest?
Our special guest today is Annie, who is David's wife.
Hello, everyone.
Her first time on Grape Encounters Radio. And the reason that she's on is it's actually twofold. The first is that Annie and I met at the Los Angeles International Wine Competition, where she's a very renowned packaging judge.
Which I didn't even know that.
You didn't know that?
I did not.
That's why she picked me. I walked up, she said, nice package. Yeah. Anyway, she is a packaging judge and has been involved in the wine industry for a really long time. But actually, there's three reasons why Annie is on. The second reason is for my birthday, she got me something that I couldn't afford to buy myself on the meager salary that I make doing Grape Encounters. And Annie, can you tell them what you bought me?
It's a Corvin.
A Corvin, yes. And Sarah, you probably would be the best one to describe what a Corvin is, because a lot of people don't really know what this device is. It's pricey, actually.
It is pricey, but it's kind of ingenious.
Okay, go for it.
So it's a very elegant, almost spacey looking device that has a small needle that you go straight through foil and cork on a bottle of wine. Presumably it's a bottle of wine that you care so much about. You maybe paid a lot for, or it's old. You don't just want to pop that cork and pour the whole thing. You might want to save it, or you're a restaurant and you want to pour a tiny bit of a very good wine and still keep the bottle. So this device goes through with a needle and then has a cartridge in it with gas that you can spray a little bit of gas into that, and it displaces a little bit of the wine, and you can pour a very small, let's say a 1.5 to 2 ounce pour of that wine with one shoot of the gas, then it stops, and you still have your bottle of wine that's protected with that layer of gas.
Which is Argon 65, by the way.
Good to know.
Which is heavy. It's heavier than air, so it sort of lays on top of the wine like a blanket, and it keeps the air from getting to the wine. And this is really a great device for people who have wine collections, and they have some very old wines, and they don't know whether the wines have turned or not, right?
Right.
Okay, so third reason that Annie gets to be on Grape Encounters for the first time is because she had a friend who was cleaning out her parents' wine collection and dispersing these bottles. And these bottles were like really old. And you see some of them now sitting on the table. And so we have sitting on the table an Inglenook that goes back to 1972.
There used to be a cornerstone winery in Napa Valley, big chateau.
In 72, yes.
Right.
It was hot stuff.
Definitely.
Okay. Yeah. And then our friends over at Lewis & Martini, I'm looking at a 1984 from the North Coast, Cabernet Sauvignon. That's in pretty good shape, by the way. You can see that the wine has not evaporated much in this particular bottle.
So probably been stored well.
Then there's an Estancia back from 1987.
When the winery was completely different. It actually makes very good value-oriented wines now, but it was a much smaller winery then with different ownership and probably more longevity in that bottle.
Okay, and then this one I'm a little concerned about. It's a Lewis M. Martini from 1968. Odds, and the wine has evaporated pretty far down the neck, which means that probably it's been displaced with air, which means its chances of surviving are
likely oxidized. Martini was a cornerstone winery in Napa Valley, but, you know, went through some hard years, maybe some lesser quality years as well.
So when you came into the studio today, did you have any idea that you were going to get the opportunity to try some of these wines?
No.
Because you would never be able
to.
You cannot buy these wines, right?
You cannot buy them.
Okay. So let's talk about the Corbin. So the device looks like a medical device, right?
It does a little bit.
Or maybe something off of Star Trek, perhaps?
A construction tool on Star Trek.
It's really a beautiful device. And not even a construction tool. It looks like it could kill people.
That's true.
And apparently there was some concern over that because they issued to all Corvin owners this little neoprene pouch. And the pouch is supposed to go around the bottle before you stick the needle into the bottle and insert the gas, because I guess a few compromised bottles were exploding.
I think I heard that too. And
it happened a few
probably
times.
Probably it was, you know, flawed glass or something, but.
Yeah. Curse you, Consumer Product Safety Commission. All right. So I'm sticking the needle into the Lewis M. Martini.
Okay.
Okay. And the needle slides right in. That's a bad sign, right? That cork's pretty soft.
It's not protecting much, that's for sure.
Okay, now there's this little grip that goes around it. Okay, just would I pull this little lever here? You've done this before.
I've done it once or twice.
All right, so now it squirts out pretty fast into the glass, and I'm not liking the color of this wine thus far. It's not looking good. I can smell it already.
You know, it's counterintuitive, but red wine does get lighter as it gets older, but this one is really, really oxidized looking, brown, amber.
Give it a smell. Oh, that face I've never seen before.
I'm afraid it smells a little bit like a muddy hayfield. What do you think, Annie?
Let's give it to Annie. Let her drink it first, huh?
All right, I'll taste it.
Okay, so before Annie takes her first sip, we're going to take a little bit of breather and get ourselves situated here. We'll be back with Sipping with Sarah and Annie on Grape Encounters Radio as we taste these very old wines and see if they're precious or poison. Okay, we've got some very, very old wine bottles here. We've opened up the first one. Are they precious or poison? Well, my wife Annie is going to take the first sip. Annie, are you ready?
All right, I'll taste it.
All right, she's going. Annie is tasting the wine.
This wine is definitely turned.
You're so gentle on it.
How many years ago do you think that turned, Sarah? Like 20, 30 years ago, probably?
I think it's been turned for a while.
Okay,
yeah.
It's been gone. But we got the bottle. We still have the wine in it. And, the nice thing about it is if you get your hands on some bottles like this, this is a lot of fun. Now, I'm looking at we have another Lewis & Martini from 1984. So who's going to do the math on that? How old is that one?
94-04, that would be 30 years.
Okay, so 30-year-old bottle of wine.
As opposed...
Hard to come by, right?
Very hard. Yeah,
okay.
It has to be in somebody's cellar.
Okay, so, or somebody's parents' house.
Right.
So I'm going to do this again. I'm taking the needle. I'm inserting it down in through the top of the bottle. Slides down. So it's so easy. It's so, oh my gosh. All right, so it's in, and now I've got a clean glass here. Push it forward. The wine comes out a little. How do you stop it? Okay, that stops it. Now I'm looking at this one, and this one is not, oh yikes. This must have been stored in Tucson. Out in the garage. I had high hopes for this one. It, honestly, the bottle had zero evaporation in it. I'm smelling it. Smells like dirty laundry.
Oh, that's not a good sign.
And that's nothing against the martini wines, because I love Mike Martini out there, but I think I'd rather have a martini.
The color, not so bad. It still has a fresh-looking redness to it.
I'm passing it around. I've had all my shots. We're all drinking out of the same glass. Oh, my gosh.
Well, when I get it in this light, it is pretty brown and oxidized.
She's drinking. No, you're not even going to sip it, are you?
I am, but I just smelled it. And that is, if there is a classic over-oxidized wine, by that I just mean through time, this is it. Yeah. It's just gone.
It's gone. Is this sad or what?
I need a funeral here.
Oh, my gosh. Dun, 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 dun. And usually you can give it to Annie. She'll drink anything. We have this bottle of Hammer Sky Party of Four. This is pretty good, right?
It is pretty good.
Yeah.
This is
really helping blend. Right now. Yeah.
It is. It's fresh. It brings us back.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Hauk, for this. Because this is like saving us from these oxidized wines. Do we dare go after the Engel? You want to go after all of them, don't you?
I especially want to go after that Engelnook.
You do? All right. Well, let's do it. Annie, is that okay?
Okay.
You got the esteemed wine editor of Sunset Magazine. You'll never get to do this with anybody with greater credentials. Don't let Wilfred Wong hear that. Here comes the Engelnook, 1972. Now, you know what's interesting about this is I had a 1972 Chateau Montalena Chardonnay made by Mike Gergich.
Wow.
And at his 93rd birthday party, and that wine was still holding strong. But it was in a wine cellar, of course, you know, and these were in somebody's cabinet.
Okay. It does make a difference. More.
Started spraying everywhere. Did you see that? What the heck?
Maybe it's not in all the way.
Oh my gosh. This thing is spraying.
We're having a volcano.
Oh my. Okay, now I'm going to tell you what. This one's, I know, I've got wine everywhere. The thing just sprayed everywhere. But now try this. This is a 72 Engelnook. I'm not even going to say anything. You just try it, okay? Okay, I'm handing it across the studio to Sarah. She sniffs. She says,
it smells like an interesting old suitcase. That has more going on.
That wine is not turned.
It still is interesting.
It's still interesting. It's not oxidized completely.
No. It still has barely a little fruit.
But that's what a wine's going to do. Typically that old, you know, people think I'm going to lay it down, you know, till I'm an old man or woman. No. But that wine's alive still.
It is. And it's just an acquired taste.
I'm licking it off the table. Why did this spew everywhere? What's the deal with that? I should have put the I don't want to call it a wine condom, but that's kind of what it is, right?
That wouldn't have helped.
That was for the bottom of the bottle. This is coming out the top.
Okay.
I think this is a really good statement about Engelnook, which most people know as a cheap jug wine, supermarket wine, but actually, the original winery in Napa, Engelnook, the big chateau, which Francis Ford Coppola bought, he's pulled it all together, the whole property, and bought the name back now. So there is now a high-end Engelnook again, like this was in 1972.
We are sitting around the studio. We have some very old bottles of wine that were recovered from an elderly couple's house. Have they passed on?
No, they have not passed on.
Oh, gosh. I buried. Well, what happened? Why did they leave these wines behind?
They are clearing out their house. It was in Tehachapi.
Oh, gosh. Tehachapi, for those who don't know, Tehachapi is like, that's like desert.
Well, it's very cold in the winter and very hot in the summer.
Yeah, it gets like 400 degrees in the summertime.
These were in the closet.
That voice being my wife, who is really one of the esteemed packaging judges at one of the largest wine competitions in the world. And then sitting next to her is probably the most respected wine editor of any lifestyle magazine in the country. You are, Sarah.
Thanks for that.
Who else? else? Who else?
Well, there aren't very many of us.
Well, I know.
It's a small group.
Yeah, it's a small group of lifestyle magazines. You're number one.
Thank you for that.
You know what? I'll tell you what. I will take on anybody who challenges you.
I'll be knocking at your door.
I'll be like your big brother to defend you if somebody tries to say that they're more esteemed.
Okay.
We have a studio table that is covered with wine, old wine, I might add, 1972 Inglenook wine that was spewed all over the table by our Corv. And I'm not blaming it, by the way, on the device, because the device seems to work pretty well.
Yeah, so I think it has.
You can suck a little wine out of an old bottle. The integrity remains intact because you're not causing any harm to the wine because you're not introducing air into the bottle. Actually, you're probably helping it out by putting some argon in there.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Because if you don't put argon in there, later on you'll be saying, oh my gosh, our wine's argon.
Like that old Inglenook all over the table.
Can you see how much wine is? It's like, you know, it didn't spray on the microphone, though. You hear that little sound? That's, my microphone's going down. Anyway, I'm letting the Inglenook just kind of, I'm just enjoying the fragrance of it. That was fun, though. The Inglenook was really in fairly good shape.
It had all of those characteristics that aren't fruit that come out when the wine gets older and older and older. And some people, most of us aren't used to that that profile because we
It doesn't taste good. I mean, it doesn't taste good.
But there's so much interesting stuff going on in there.
You know what I really love? I love to drink Madeiras.
Well, you're talking some age there.
Yeah, I've had some 200-year-old Madeiras.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, and but they're pre-oxidized, so there's no problem. It's like permanent press.
Oxidation is part of the package.
Yeah, it is. And those are interesting because what I love about Madeiras is that 200 years ago, they grew the grapes up on the top of the mountain on the island of Madeira, which is, roughly between Spain and Africa.
Right.
It's really hot there. And the wines are going to oxidize. And they don't care about the temperature in the winery because it doesn't matter. And the kind of grapes that they used, a lot of them, by the way, are extinct now. So you can buy Madeiras that are made from grapes that don't exist on planet Earth anymore.
That is so fascinating.
Isn't it? Yeah. And what they did. They'd crush the grapes up on top of the mountain. And then they would take a sheepskin. And it wasn't like a Bota bag. We're talking about a Bota bag made out of an entire sheep. And they would sew the whole thing up, right? And then they would crush the juice and they'd put it in the sheepskin. And then it would sometimes take a couple of days to trek down from the top of the mountain down to the seashore where they finished the wine and they stored it for years.
Those mountains are precipitous on that.
They're precipitous is exactly right. And so what did the wine do? It picks up the taste, not of a barrel, but of a sheep, a dead sheep. And so when you drink those 200-year-old, why are you looking at me like that? You don't like lamb chops?
Sure.
Anyway.
Just do the pairing once.
That's a bad taste.
Oh, God. You see why I keep her away from the microphone? All right. Anyway, so they haul the sheepskins down. And you know what would happen, by the way, a lot of the time is that the guys who were hauling, and it was guys, it wasn't women. I'm sorry. I'm not being sexist. But they would haul it down and they would drink some of the wine as it was fermenting at that point. They would drink it and then they would refill it with water along the way. So we kind of water down the wine a little bit. Did you know all this?
I didn't.
Oh, yeah.
But would the water affect the fermentation?
No, it would just affect the amount of alcohol. But see, what would happen is it's a fortified wine, obviously. So they over the years, continue to add sugar to it. So who cares? Yeah. But you can taste that sheepskin 200 years later in those wines. And they're really not expensive. This is the funny thing is that for the price of a good Napa cab, you can buy a 200-year-old Madeira. And I guarantee you, I mean, it's going to be gold in color, kind of goldish red.
Right.
It's so good.
Amazing.
And you can taste that, you can taste the history in that wine more than anything else that I know because of the way that they made it. And what's also interesting about that wine is that they make a conscious decision that they're going to keep some of this wine for like 1,000 years or whatever. And so they only sell a certain amount each year or each decade. And they consciously keep some of the wine around for hundreds of years.
Sounds like a brilliant business model.
And then they put it in bottles, and then they from time to time recork those bottles.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of 100-year-old ones upstairs.
Hmm.
Okay. I drank them. I just have the bottles. Okay. All right. Estancia it is. What can you tell us about the Estancia vineyards, Sarah Schneider?
I don't know about those years. years of
Estancia. Well, how about today?
Now it's a large operation. The winemaker is actually a hugely talented guy. He was actually a beer brewer by choice in college, but he's now with Estancia. He took the fermenting stuff to wine. And Estancia makes a ton of wine. It's a very large operation, but they always over-deliver on their price. They're well-priced wines, but always you get a little more than you paid for.
All right, so your expectations from this 1987 Estancia, stored in the desert of California for 27 years.
Let's see.
Are you hopeful?
Not so much.
Okay, all right.
But
all right, I've got the Corvin in, I believe. I hope it does not spew all over me like it did the last time. And I hope the bottle does not blow up. Okay. No, we're not going to use the sheath. Okay, here we go. All right, I'm squirting. I'll give this to you. Hang on.
That's not promising.
Well, I'm sliding it down the bar.
There you go.
It's very, very, what?
It's sherry. It has the oxidation
it's sherry?
Of, it's sherry, matterized, that what they do to artificially oxidize, a sherry. This is what's coming off the nose here.
It's tart. Wait, it's so tart, you won't even believe it. It's a sherry tart.
Actually, that's kind of interesting. Pass it to Annie.
I noticed you.
But it has that nuttiness and that caramelization.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
You're getting a very dry sherry.
All right, so here's the roundup. We pulled out the Corvin, a very expensive device, but very clever. It did spew on me a little bit. We opened up two bottles of Louis M. Martini wines, a 1968 and 1984. They did not hold up well. The moral of the story is get yourself a Corvin, and you can go gather up some old bottles of wine, and you can test them. And if they're good, then invite friends over and show off. And if they're not good, invite friends show over and show off, but don't give them any of the wine. It seems fair, right?
That's fair.
Okay, coming up next is someone I wish could have been here with Annie and Sarah and I for that last segment, but he arrived just a little bit late. It is our wine guru from wine.com, the inimitable Wilfred Wong.
You are listening to Grape Encounters Radio with David Wilson, broadcasting from our wine cellar studio in idyllic Atascadero, centrally located in the Central Coast wine country of San Luis Obispo County, California.
Hi, and welcome to the Wilfred Wong Show. I'm David Wilson, filling in for Wilfred today. Hey, Wilfred, time for another grape encounter. Wilfred, are you there?
I'm here.
Wilfred Wong, the chief storyteller from wine.com. Hey, Wilfred, remember we were talking about Pinots?
Yes.
And you had mentioned the fact that if you were looking for a good Pinot, one of the things to do is maybe to focus on single vineyard Pinots.
Well, I would focus on serious producers that make single vineyard Pinot Noirs because you have better control.
And like in like 10 seconds, the reason why is?
More control and usually higher quality.
So I want to move the conversation this week on to the subject of estate grown versus not estate grown.
Okay.
Because we've had a lot of conversation, not you and I particularly, but a lot of conversation about the amount of juice that is being bought and sold and grapes that are being bought and sold and wine that's being made under umpteen gazillion different labels. I think anybody can wrap their arms around because it used to be that you knew that at the Wilfred Wong Vineyards, they grew the grapes right out there around the winery. They were grown on the property and that Wilfred was out there tending the grapes every day. And he had a handle on those grapes. And he loved them like his own children until he stomped them to death.
True. Very true.
But now there are a lot of people that just want to be in the wine business, right? So they just buy grapes and they attempt to be winemakers. And then there are still others who buy up all the other grapes that can't be sold. And they make bulk wine. And none of that is necessarily good.
It's more difficult to do it that way for quality. I mean, the best quality are often, if you control the estate, there's a better chance that you will have higher quality. Not always, but a better chance.
I think in general, that's got to be true.
Yeah.
You know, I live on a vineyard, and trust me, I don't own the vineyard because I do a radio show. I don't grow grapes, nor do I make wine, but I might someday if this radio thing doesn't work out.
Okay.
But so far, 5 years, it's worked out just fine. But, you know, but I look at the amount of effort that all of my grape growing friends put into their vineyards. It's hard work.
It's very hard work.
This is the thing that I think that's really important is they can't afford to make a mistake.
They're trying their best to tend the grapes to be to the best quality they can get from that vineyard.
So here's the part that I think a lot of people don't get. The pendulum swings very far. On one end of the pendulum is the grape grower who is not the least bit concerned about the quantity of grapes he produces. He's only or she's only concerned about the quality of the grapes that they produce. Other end of the pendulum are the bulk producers who are going to try to get as much tonnage off that property as they possibly can to make the most amount of juice. And then what the heck, if it doesn't taste quite right, we can add sugars, we can add extracts, we can add tannins, we can add whatever we need to, acids, whatever, to make it taste a little more palatable to the general public. That unfortunately is happening more and more and more and more, and we're getting more and more creative, are we not, in terms of the way we tinker with wine?
Well, we are definitely getting more creative on how we tinker with wine. All kinds of gizmos used by winemakers now to augment the quality of a wine. I would say there's one term that comes to mind really quickly to me. It's called wine growers. Okay, a wine grower is a grape grower, but a wine grower is more specifically someone who is growing grapes for making wine. I mean, mentally and spiritually, and try and make it best.
Do you know that you actually have made just a very good point here?
I did?
No, well, yeah, you did. Because I've kind of used the terms interchangeably, but that's a very interesting distinction. Wine growers, grape growers.
A grape grower wants tonnage. They want money for their crops, like growing corn, whatever.
Right. They're selling by the pound.
Yes, but a wine grower wants quality and wants to do the best thing for that vineyard they have that the owner have control over. The key for these growers is they know the vineyard. They know what they got to do. It's not necessarily making the lowest yield possible. It's doing the best thing for those vines to train it to become the best it can be. So basically, you can underproduce too to the degree that you overdid it. You have to just, it's about balance, making sure the vine is trained correctly, so it's a balanced grape. It's a balanced vine for balanced flavors.
Okay, so here's the last and very tough question. Are you prepared?
Of course.
When we talk about Zinfandel, you often hear the term old vines or century vines.
Yes.
And it's a great thing to have 100-year-old Zinfandel vines, okay? For almost any other grape, when the vines begin to get old, they tear them out and they put in new vineyards. Why?
When you say old vines, Zinfandel, two things come to mind. One is the age, okay? I think that first of all, it's a marketing term to start with. It's not a totally legitimate term of quality. If a vine is 100 years old or 40 years old, it's still a mature vine. They say that once a vine gets to 10, 15 years, it's mature. Now, some people will argue that old vines, like a century old vines, are better than vines that are 40 years old. I don't think that's totally true.
But with Zinfandel, you don't hear that.
No.
You don't hear old vine
right.
Merlot.
No. And with Zinfandel, however, the other thing about old vines is the old vines inherently, because the Italians planted so much Zinfandel in California, they're usually mixed with other varietals. So the old vines is also implies a mixture of more than Zinfandel. So it's part of the nomenclature. Old vine does not necessarily mean age of vine. It means that it's a vine that may be interplanted with, say, Carignan or other grapes that are part of that Italian group family.
Okay.
As far as Merlot and other things, you don't hear that because the rule of thumb for vineyards, once a vine is 10 to 15 years old, it's mature. It's going to give you what it is going to show no matter how old it is.
And then at what point do you tear it out?
When it's not producing well or when it's sick and old. I mean,
yeah.
if it's sickly looking or if it's not producing well, then you take it out.
Grapes are, as much as they like to grow in very distressed conditions, they're sickly.
Yes.
Grapes are sickly. Grapes do not go to their physician regularly, nor do they...
Grapes get replanted all the time. I mean, grapes get replanted all the time. I mean, if you talk about like Burgundy or Bordeaux, they usually replant every 25 years.
Everything.
Yeah, because they get old and they die and they don't yield that much and the fruit is not that good anyway. So, yeah, I mean, they're in the heydays between like 15 and 35 years old.
Wilfred Wong, the chief storyteller from wine.com, one of our great friends here at Grape Encounters Radio. Wilfred, I don't know what we're going to talk about next week.
I'm sure you've come up with it soon.
But you can't play God next week.
I can't?
Oh, no, my God. You may not.
Oh, that's terrible.
Right.
That changed my life.
You never know what part of the country or the world the Grape Encounters microphones will take you to. Don't miss a single experience. Your Grape Encounter isn't over. We're just taking a breather until next week's edition.